You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today.
But what's even cooler is that it not only shatters the record, it shattered the lab.
We begin counting down the biggest physics stories of 2018 with Ian Durham.
We found ancient hydrogen that's about as half as warm as it should be. It's fascinating.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to what has become an annual tradition for the Foundational Questions Institute podcast, as we review the highlights and some lowlights of the past year. As always for the countdown, I'm joined by FQXI member and quantum physicist Ian Durham of St Onsem College in New Hampshire. Hello, Ian. Thank you very much for joining us again to go through the biggest and best and maybe some of the worst stories of 2018.
Thank you for having me again. I really appreciate it. I enjoy doing this. It's a highlight of my year.
And as you've seen on Twitter, we do get requests about this. You know, people look forward to this.
And I get to talk about controversial stuff, which is always fun.
You're causing the controversy half the time with your choices.
I know, but you let me.
How do you want to do this then? We've got honorable mentions, dishonorable mentions, we've kind of fun stuff. What do you want to start with?
Let's talk about the fun stuff first.
Right.
This is the groundbreaking strong magnetic field at the University of Tokyo. So some researchers at the University of Tokyo created the strongest controllable magnetic field in history that was indoors. So the Russians have one outdoors that beat them. So this is a 1200 Tesla magnetic field that these guys created. But what's even cooler is that it not only shatters the record, it shattered the lab.
So actually, why are you giving this an honorable mention? Is it because of the science, or is it just because you admire them so much for blowing up their lab?
It's because I admire them so much for blowing up the lab. Right. No, I mean, it's great science. This blew what they were expecting out of the water. They were expecting about 700 Tesla. They got 1,200, which is why the lab blew up. They weren't expecting it to be that big. And just for the sake of comparison, the magnets that you put on your refrigerator are about 0.01 Tesla. So this would be 120,000 times a magnet on your refrigerator. The technique's been around since the 1940s, and it's basically to squeeze the magnetic field into a smaller and smaller and smaller size. In the 40s, they used to use TNT to do this. So they literally used to blow stuff up to create these magnetic fields. And what these guys did is they dumped about 3.2 megajoules, that's a lot of energy, into a generator. There was a weak magnetic field that was in a coil, but it caused this magnetic field to compress at a rate of about 20,000 miles per hour. They had to feed 4 million amps of current through the generator, which is several thousand times more than a lightning bolt. I can't fathom what their electric bill was.
You know, serious point on the science of it. Why are they trying to create these strong magnetic fields?
Why not?
Fair enough.
It provides a lot of insight into how different materials respond to magnetic fields. I imagine there are probably astronomers who are very interested in this too, because there are some extremely strong magnetic fields in astrophysical phenomena out there, tremendously strong magnetic fields, and we have no way to probe what that environment is like. There are also possible applications in fusion reactor designs. Personally, I just think it's cool.
And there is a lovely quote here from IEEE Spectrum, from one of the physicists involved, Shujiro Takayama at the University of Tokyo, who said, "I didn't expect it to be so high. Next time I'll make the enclosure stronger." So there you go. Great attitude.
And I have an anecdote to go with this.
Okay.
I had a professor in college who blew the back off a building once.
Okay. You have to tell this story, yeah.
As an undergrad, I studied hypersonic fluid flow. There was a company that was associated with the university, and they still have hypersonic shock tunnels. And the way you get something like that is you have this long tube, let's say 100 meters long, and that opens up then into a traditional wind tunnel kind of housing. And to get the air to reach the speeds that you wanted, you would pressurize this tube, and then there would be this metal disc or diaphragm in near the front, and you would etch it in a certain way, and then it would burst at a particular pressure, and whatever pressure it was that burst at it would tell you what the speed of the fluid was that was coming out of the tube. And my professor, before I had him, this was back in the 60s or something, my professor did not etch his diaphragm correctly, and it never blew, and so the back of the thing blew, and it blew the back off the building, which at that time was brick. And after that, they replaced the back wall of that building with corrugated metal hung on little hooks so that if it ever happened again, it would just, you know, flap up and flap back down again. So.
This makes me wonder what it takes to get yourself fired as a physics professor, because apparently destroying the building is not enough.
I did earlier this semester actually melt a table. It was an open house and I had a demo and some parents and students were coming by and I wasn't watching my demo very closely and it literally melted right through the table and fell to the floor.
So I feel like we should just have a separate list of weird things that have happened in Ian's lab.
No, anyway, we can go on now.
So that was an honorable mention.
Yes.
So we haven't actually got into the top five yet, but what didn't make it?
All right, so one thing that didn't make it, I guess it would be a dishonorable mention. Part of the reason that this didn't make it is because it's been questioned, there's no definite conclusion on this, is that some folks have cast some doubt on LIGO's results. And this is a big kerfuffle recently.
So just to recap, LIGO, as our listeners will know, famously announced the first detection of gravitational waves back in 2016. These ripples in space-time were thought to have been set off when two black holes collided. In 2017, the leaders of the project picked up the Nobel Prize in Physics, and since then they have announced further discoveries, including the detection of a collision by two neutron stars that also gave off optical signals that were picked up by independent telescopes. It's the very first of these detection claims that became the centre of some controversy and has been called into question by a team of independent physicists in Denmark. You know, as I understand it, this team led by Andrew Jackson made claims more than a year ago about there being some trouble that he found when his team tried to reproduce LIGO's results from the data that had been made public. And it hasn't really gone away, even though people from the LIGO collaboration did try to contact him and discuss this with him. And then there was some stuff going out on some blogs and it was kind of bubbling around this kind of back and forth online. And then it resurfaced about a month ago in New Scientist and people were talking about it all over again.
It was a few Danish scientists, and LIGO's response is that there absolutely is no validity to their claims. Basically, the LIGO folks are saying that the controversy boils down to a misunderstanding of how LIGO analyzes its data. Nevertheless, I thought it was worth mentioning that these guys who published in the Journal of Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics that they were claiming that LIGO's observation was really an illusion.
We've again had people contacting us on Twitter and asking us about this. You know, should we just throw out all the LIGO results? Was LIGO all just nonsense?
And I understand. In fact, you and I were at that meeting in Cambridge. If you remember, we wandered into that meeting where they announced gravitational waves in the
Bicep 2,
and it turned out that was nothing.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case here.
So I guess, first of all, just on that level, we're not thinking that LIGO was an illusion or LIGO's detection was an illusion. We're kind of solid that, you know, we shouldn't be worried about that. LIGO did actually make detections, or are we not?
No, I have no doubt that they did. It seems to me that these guys know what they're doing. They've had events since, so it hasn't just been that one event that they announced in 2016. They keep getting results, right? So we've seen several different events occur through LIGO. And in fact, hasn't there been one where they were actually able to then follow it up and find the optical equivalent of where it was coming from?
Yeah, I think that was on our list last year, maybe.
It might have been, yeah. You know, again, this just seems odd to me. I have a hard time believing that the LIGO results are not real. I think they're perfectly real.
So I don't want to focus on the kind of the technical aspects of this claim because it gets quite involved and there are some nice articles that we can link to on the website that unpack all of that. But more this other issue, which we have talked about before in other contexts, of what do you do when you have a big experiment, or I think we've sort of talked about it before with some of the mathematicians that you've chosen before in the past, where somebody has put forward a claim or a proof And either because it's a huge collaboration which costs billions of dollars to put together, or because it's a mathematician who spent, you know, years and years and years working on this and nobody else is really up to speed on what they're doing, it's very difficult for people from the outside to come in and look at it and check it and be satisfied that actually the claim is true. So I just wonder if you have any thoughts about how LIGO in this case could have handled the situation better, or how actually other collaborations or other teams or other people can kind of deal with this question of reproducibility. It's sort of an ideal in science, but it's becoming less and less practical.
Yeah, so I think one of the knocks against LIGO is that they are known for being a little secretive, and I think maybe more transparency on their part would be helpful.
Well, let me ask you it this way. So he's a reputable scientist, it's a reputable group, and they have published in a reputable journal. In such a case, should, not perhaps LIGO in this case, but whoever is being criticized, is it their responsibility to reply to the criticism in a published paper? Or is it enough to reply on a blog? You know, as a scientist, what's your responsibility to dealing with criticism?
That's a good question. I think in some cases, it should be done in a peer-reviewed journal. I think maybe in this case, that might be a worthwhile thing, but LIGO would have to be able to figure out where these guys went wrong. And that may not be as easy a task as one would think. Just from my own teaching, and if I'm grading a complex problem that a student gets wrong, sometimes it's hard to figure out where the student went wrong. And so, you know, the student is clearly wrong, but where did the student mess up? In very complicated situations, it's often very difficult to tell. And so I think it might be best if they could counter it in a published journal, but they may not be able to. And they may not honestly have the time, and if they think that their data stands up and their methods stand up and the majority of the community is behind them, then they may not bother. Science is about consensus, right? If another group comes out and says, yeah, we actually got the same results as the Danish group, then LIGO might want to stop and say, maybe we better take a look at this.
Right, right.
I will also say this, and I do not know Jackson and his group. I absolutely respect the work that they've done, but good scientists make mistakes, and good scientists sometimes do things that they don't fully understand, and sometimes do bad science. I mean, it happens.
Right.
And it's very possible that Jackson made a mistake.
So that was sort of, I guess, worth a mention because we've included LIGO multiple years, I think, on our end of year review. So the fact that there was a little bit of confusion and controversy around it, well, it's good to kind of acknowledge that. Right, so on to the actual list now. What comes in at fifth place?
Da-da-da, we have a tie. Sitting at fifth place, we have a tie between two interesting experiments. The first is that a group of scientists traced the birthplace of high-energy neutrinos to a galactic source. So this is the ice cube experiment in Antarctica. They were able to nail down the origins of some neutrinos that they found as coming from a type of bright galaxy called a blazar that happens to be located in the constellation of Orion. It comes from an area of Orion known as Orion's armpit, by the way.
You know, our listeners will remember we spoke to somebody who was involved with this on the podcast a few months ago, Azadeh Kivani, and she was so excited because it's this kind of example of multi-messenger astronomy, because when IceCube had the detection, they then, you know, in real time sent a message out to a whole load of other telescopes around the world, and they all jumped on it and started kind of training their various kinds of telescopes, which all look at different kinds of signals in that direction to try and pinpoint it.
So first of all, we've known about neutrinos for years. They are extraordinarily difficult to detect because they, as far as we know, they only interact weakly. They were predicted by Hans Bethe back in the 40s, I think. We detected them first in the 60s. The thing about it is that the neutrinos were coming from the sun. Sometimes we'll come across neutrinos that were very high energy neutrinos. And those were a puzzle because they couldn't possibly have come from the sun, because we know the mechanism that creates the neutrinos in the sun. And these neutrinos didn't have the right energies. So something had to be creating them, and we didn't know where they were coming from. And these are really high energy. They're way beyond what most particle accelerators can create on Earth. So these guys were able to pin down that it was coming from the direction of Orion, and there's a bright galaxy over there called a blazar, and that it was being produced there. And to be honest with you, I'm not entirely well-versed in what a blazar is. My guess is there's probably a really big black hole sitting there at the center of that thing.
Another nice example of all of these teams, all of these collaborations coming together to kind of solve a bit of a mystery there. So yeah, so that's joint fifth place.
With another sort of astronomy related one. So they have figured out that ancient hydrogen that we've detected in the universe is colder than expected. And this actually has implications for studies of dark matter.
So it's really interesting to me because I was expecting this one to appear on the list because it was huge when it came out. And what was interesting was that in a lot of the news stories, they were just excited that they found this light from so very early on in the universe, from the first stars in the universe. And you've sort of come at it, you've kind of focused on the fact that the hydrogen was colder than expected, and this sort of suggestion about what this might tell us about dark matter, and that it maybe interacts in a way that people hadn't been expecting in the simplest models.
So dark matter makes up about 26.8%, I guess, of the total mass and energy in the universe. We still have no idea what dark matter is, none whatsoever. The only way to detect it is through gravity. So a team at Arizona State was using this all-sky radio antenna in Western Australia called EDGES to look for faint signatures of primordial hydrogen. They're looking for the 21-centimeter line, a very famous emission line in hydrogen, which is basically, if you think about hydrogen, basic hydrogen has a proton and an electron, and they both have spin. And if their spin is aligned, so let's say they're both spin up, the electron and the proton, that configuration has more energy than if their spin is anti-aligned. So say the proton has spin up and the electron has spin down. Every once in a while, it'll transition from the one state to the other, and it'll produce a 21-centimeter photon. And basically, they were looking for these in the early universe, and they were looking for the redshift of these photons coming from this very early hydrogen. And they detected some of this emission, and it's supposed to be from very early in the universe, but it was redshifted not as much as it should have been by cosmic expansion. And it turned out to only be about 180 million years after the Big Bang. And the amplitude of the signal was twice as large as it had been predicted. And basically, the only way to explain this is that if the gas in the early universe was colder than expected. So the temperature at this point was supposed to be about 6 degrees above absolute zero, but the strength of the signal indicated that it was closer to 3 degrees. The suggestion is that it's possible that dark matter is the reason that the hydrogen has this very low temperature. Because at that point, the only matter that should have been colder than the hydrogen would be the dark matter. And so if the hydrogen and the dark matter particles, whatever the heck they are, were scattered off one another, they would remove the heat from the hydrogen atoms, which would explain why the hydrogen was only 3 Kelvin rather than 6 Kelvin.
We also talked about this on the podcast a while back when it came out. So when it was published in Nature, it was published as 2 separate papers. And the one of them just deals with the observation. And the other one is by a theoretical physicist, Renan Bakana, who talked to us on the podcast, who's come up with this sort of possible explanation in terms of dark matter. And it's sort of interesting that the two were separated and yet published together. And also on the podcast, we were talking to Brian Keating, who wrote a book earlier this year, which deals with the Bicep 2 sort of fiasco that we also have mentioned on this podcast. And the people from the EDGES experiment apparently told him that one of the reasons they published it in this way in 2 separate papers was because of the controversy around Bicep. Because Bicep 2, you mentioned it earlier, they went public with an announcement that they had found evidence of primordial gravitational waves, and it turned out they hadn't. But they had actually seen something. It's just their interpretation that was wrong. And so this team, very early on, when they found that they got a very surprising signal, as you say, They got involved with a theoretical physicist to think about an interpretation, but they didn't want to publish the two in the same paper for that reason, that they wanted to keep the solid observation in one paper and the speculation on what it might be in another paper.
I think that was a really smart idea on their part, because sometimes really good, important observations that could be interesting in their own right get overshadowed if they are then published along with an interpretation that, right or wrong, tends to grab the headlines because people want to know what this stuff means when it's published. Mm. It's not that interpretation that made this make my list. It's the fact that we found ancient hydrogen that's about as half as warm as it should be. Mm. That's really amazing and really interesting in and of its own right.
Congratulations then to the magnetic field makers at the University of Tokyo, the neutrino origin detectors at IceCube, and the ancient hydrogen analyzers working with the EDGES experiment. You can find out more about their discoveries and about the LIGO kerfuffle on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Now, I was expecting both the neutrino experiment and the first light experiment to feature on Ian's list this year, because both made huge headlines when they were announced, but I was expecting them to place a lot higher. So what could possibly have pushed them down to fifth place on the next edition?
It's fascinating. It suggests that time is maybe an emergent property.
We find out Ian's top four picks.
This is when things start to get interesting and potentially controversial. Number two was originally going to be number one, and the only possible thing that could knock it off of number one is what number one is.
Until then, as always, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org, on Twitter at FQXI, and on Facebook at FQXI Physics. Thanks again for now to Ian Durham, whom you can also find on Twitter at QuantumMoxie. Thanks for listening. I've been Zia Morali.